This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Let me first say thanks to Rob for having me here. Also, how much I appreciate the 9 a.m. slot that I just took as a kind of hazing ritual here. But thank you, really, to all of you who are here right now. I think what I'm going to talk about today is really important for pinball, and I'm glad to see that the people who are serious about it are here, and I'm really happy to be here and talking about this. So I think it's appropriate to start this talk with a really basic question, but it's also a really big, complicated question, which I'll try not to be, which I'll try not to overcomplicate. But I think it's really appropriate to start with a question, because a lot of what I'm going to talk about and that I'm going to suggest here, I'm really hoping to raise more questions than potentially providing answers, though I hope I do that as well. But before we kind of plunge into how do we preserve the history of pinball, as Dave kind of suggested, I want to give you a brief background on who we are. We're the Strong, the National Museum of Play. We're the nation's Museum of Play. We are situated in Rochester, New York. And the brief kind of founding story is that we opened to the public in 1982, so we've been around for decades. But the museum was chartered in 1969. Our founder and really chief benefactor was a woman named Margaret Woodbury Strong, and she was a Rochester native, and she came from a very affluent family. She traveled the world, and I believe her paternal grandfather, or I believe, was he made his fortune in the buggy whip industry. So that tells you how far back this goes. But when Margaret collected things, she was a huge collector and filled her house with all sorts of objects. But she had a world-class collection of toys and dolls. And when she passed away in 1969, shortly after she got the charter for the museum, she left behind millions of dollars. She was the principal, the largest single shareholder of Eastman Kodak stock when she passed away, which today doesn't really mean a lot. But in 1969, that was good stock to have. So she left behind millions of dollars to found a museum, what she called at the time, of fascination. So again, it opened to the public in 1982. Now you can see that there was about a decade between the time that she passed away and the time that the museum actually opened. And the museum opened as a different kind of museum. It opened as a museum that was about the history and the impact of industrialization on everyday life up to 1945, which is an interesting, an interesting topic. But one that we did not stay with for long. The mission of the museum changed ultimately to focus on play. And that's what we do. The museum is dedicated to the study and the exploration of play. And we explore, we celebrate, and we study how play, really the importance of play in human growth and development. But also, it's really a history museum at its core. And so we look at how play illuminates our cultural history, how it has changed over time. Now, the museum itself is 285,000 square feet. It's one of the largest history museums in the country. It has more than 100,000 square feet of exhibits and displays dedicated to play. And we get more than 550,000 visitors a year, somewhere between 550 and 600,000, which is pretty good in a market where there's a lake directly to the north of you. So just to, I guess, touch a little bit on Dave's kind of initial question, the Strong houses several different programs. The first is the one that I'm the assistant director of, which is iCHEG, which is our Center for the History of Electronic Games. And, you know, for particularly for this audience, where you think of pinball, many of you are not going to think of pinball as an electronic game, but really for, you know, about half of its life now, it has been an electronic game, which is, you know, one of the reasons that we're interested in it. That's our Center for the History of Electronic Games. It also houses the National Toy Halls of Fame. And every year we induct two or three of the most significant toys or games of all time. It's the vehicle that most people encounter the museum. You know, iCHEG is great, but most people on the street are not going to think about a Center for the History of Electronic Games. But a National Toy Hall of Fame, a World Video Game Hall of Fame, are great vehicles for reaching out to the public and talking with them about the history of play. And I'll note that the National Toy Hall Halls of Fame, that exhibit was recently renovated. It was a $4 million project funded in large part by the Toy Industry Association. And so it was in partnership with them that we actually brought the Toy Industry Association's Hall of Fame as well. So now the National Toy Hall of Fame celebrates both the toys themselves, but also the inventors and the executives that were involved in it. I mentioned the World Video Game Hall of Fame. We inducted our first class in 2014. In 2015, and also the Brian Sutton Smith Library and Archives of Play. This is where it's a 150,000 volume library. It holds archives, personal papers, company papers, a significant collection that we just acquired through donation from Gund, which is the stuffed animal company. They've also supported, in part, another exhibit that we've done on the history of figurative play. We also publish the American Journal of Play, which is a scholarly journal that's published three times a year. It's available in print, but also online for free. So I'd urge you to check that out. It's something that, it's a multidisciplinary journal, so there are early childhood educators, there are historians, sociologists, anthropologists, you name it, writing about the importance of play, they're studying play. One of the areas I think that pinball, a kind of challenge for pinball, is justifying why is it important? Why does pinball matter? And, you know, the video game industry has a lot of money to do studies. But what I hear a lot is, you know, pinball's in bars, and we need to get pinball in bars. And I don't hear a lot of conversation about why does pinball matter to people, right? What sort of form of play? I mean, that's a different talk that maybe I could do another time, but think of the strategy. Think of the kind of spatial reasoning that goes into playing pinball. What are really the benefits of that form of play? And the last thing is the Woodbury School. So we have a full preschool that uses the Reggio Emilia approach, which is a really it's a student-centered play curriculum where play and discovery and exploration comes really from the student itself. So all these things are part of the Strong. They're all part of our mission of exploring, studying, and preserving play. Now, we're, as I said, a collections-based museum. So we house the world's largest and most comprehensive collection of playthings and historical materials related to play. And I'll just mention a couple of things here. Up in the corner here, how many of you like Monopoly. There's generally a love-or-hate relationship with that game. We all have some sort of memory of it. So this is actually the prototype for Monopoly. This was Charles Darrow who popularized Monopoly. He created this game. It's a handmade game from 1933, and it's part of the museum's collection. It's on display at the Strong. We really have the most comprehensive collection of Monopoly materials. And you know, several interesting things about this, but Darrow actually used you know, molding from around the house to create the homes. He hand typed the cards. He found little trinkets from around the house to use as game pieces. Monopoly, if you don't know the history of that game, it's really fascinating. I suggest you kind of explore that a bit. Below it, you'll see some notebooks. Here's really a test. How many of you have heard of the name Sid Sackson? Oh, of course. Yeah. So Sid Sackson was really the most prolific board game and game creator, inventor, really ever. And probably his best known game was a game called Acquire. And you know, just made hundreds of games, and we have his personal papers, his notebooks. These notebooks here that you see are actually indexed. He wrote down, I've never, ever seen anything like this. It's an incredible resource. But he wrote down everything that he read, everything that he did, every phone call. So if he had a phone call with somebody about his game, he wrote down the phone call, who he spoke to. And then at the end of the year, he would index everything in the back of this notebook. It's just an incredible resource. I'll mention one more. Does anyone, next to Han Solo there, does anybody know what this is right here? No, okay. So this is an example of Thomas Edison's talking doll. It's from the 1890s. There are very few of these left, and the real short story of this is that Edison created these dolls, and he used wax cylinders inside the doll here. And he had this whole army of young women who were recording nursery rhymes, and the idea was to, you know, to record to the wax cylinder, and you'd the doll would talk, right? This was the earliest version of a talking doll. And what's particularly interesting about this is that it's one of the biggest commercial failures ever. He made thousands and thousands of these things. But if you ever, and I would, I'd ask if you have any interest at all to go online, just afterwards Google Thomas Edison talking doll and listen to the sound that came out of this thing. It was so creepy. Dolls already are creepy, but the sound of this doll was so creepy that it scared the hell out of children. And so it was one of the biggest commercial failures, probably Edison's biggest failure. You also see, obviously, arcade games as well, which are part of our collection. Pinball, of course. I mentioned we have 100,000 square feet of exhibit space. I just want to mention a few of them. You know, up in the corner here, this is our new National Toy Hall of Fame gallery. In the middle, Reading Adventureland, which is a giant pop-up book that deals with the history of children's literature. And one of the things that we talk about is what are the things that inspire play, right? So we have an exhibit called American Comic Book Heroes, which looks at the history of comic books, but also the way in which they inspire play, right? So think of children throwing a cape on, right? Just or taking, picking up a stick and playing swords or becoming heroes. A few other exhibits here, Game Time, which Dave would probably be most interested in, which is an exhibit on the history of non-electronic games, puzzles, e-game revolution, 5,000 square foot exhibit on the history of electronic games, Field of Play, which is really our introduction to play, as I say, with a capital P, right? Why do we play? What is the history of play? What do we get out of play? Why is it so important? Down the corner here is, we do temporary exhibits. We did a temporary exhibit summer 2014 that focused on the history of pinball playfield design. You can see there looking at a couple of Steve's machines with a whitewood for high speed. We also have exhibits, like we have an exhibit on the history of Sesame Street, which we've worked with Sesame Workshop to create. I'll just quickly talk about our approach to exhibits, because you look at some of those pictures, and it looks a lot like a children's museum. And people still think that. I mean, we get people who walk into the museum and they're like, "Where's the museum? Where do I look at stuff? Where's the cases where I just stare at things for an hour?" So that's really not how we do museums. Our approach is, it's really a three-legged stool. There are artifacts, right? We're a collections-based museum, so we want people to engage with our collection as best as we can. We have, we have a world-class collection of playthings. We want people to see it. Also, we want people to be able to understand, to contextualize those objects, those artifacts, those forms of play. And so we do different kinds of things to interpret those objects and those forms of play. And then we allow them to play. And we do that through interactives. So a lot of times we actually think of ourselves as being kinds of play designers, right? That we're creating with exhibits, we're creating spaces that people are going to play in. Because we understand that people learn and people play in different ways. So we try to engage all the senses. We try to engage people at different levels, so we know that people are going to come to the museum, and some of them are going to read labels. Some people are not going to read any labels. They're not interested in interpretation, but they're there to play. And we believe that play is so important that it is a learning experience. These kids right here, which are playing a giant Perplexus, are doing kind of spatial reasoning and problem solving. And the fact that they're doing it together is they're actually working together to try to get that ball through that puzzle. Play is incredibly valuable and has a lot to teach us. And so we try to do that in each one of our exhibits. Okay, so how do you preserve the history of pinball? Let's get to the meaty stuff. Well, so when we created the International Center for the History of Electronic Games, we really thought hard about a kind of interpretive approach. How are people going to look at, how are people going to examine, how are they going to understand the history of electronic games? And this is an approach that I think applies broadly to play and specifically to pinball. And we thought about it in terms of concentric circles, right? So it's multi-layered, and you're continually zooming in and out of focus. So if we go to very tight focus, we're thinking about, we're asking big questions, but narrow questions about the games themselves, right? How do people play this particular game? So you think of something like high speed. How does that work? How is it played? What sort of thing does it do differently? What kinds of questions can we ask of the game itself? And then we go to a bit of a broader focus on the producers of the game, right? So Steve had a role in obviously designing high speed. What sort of thinking went into that? But it's more than that, because It's not only the thinking of Steve, but it's also the labor of the process. What sort of processes were in place? Who worked on the game? How did it fit into the industry or the business itself, and then the industry? Right? Who are these people? What exactly did they do? To a wider focus to the players, right? So thinking about the experience of the play, what is it like to play high speed? What sort of effect does that game have on you? What can a player tell us about their experiences? And then to a really much more panoramic view of play as a whole, right? That this is a form of play. What is it about pinball specifically, games more generally, and play much more broadly? And so we think of how these things go in and out of focus. And this is where we started, because these are questions in terms of how are people going to think about this stuff now, but also how are people going to think about what sort of questions might they ask 100 years from now? And we're always trying to anticipate that. So for us, this was a basic framework for understanding how do we move forward with now preserving, right? In order to preserve materials, you need to know what it is that you're going to save, and you're guided by certain questions and principles. So who's doing pinball preservation work? So everybody up here, whether they know it or not, is doing a kind of form of preservation work. The Internet Pinball Database, right? It's doing fabulous stuff. It's getting materials out there. It's putting them out there in a way that makes it easily accessible, and just it's incredibly valuable, the work that they're doing. And then you have a series of smaller pinball museums that are really making these games accessible to people, right? That's really what their mission is, essentially. I think Pacific Pinball Museum is really has a distinct educational focus, but in part they're all getting these games accessible for people to play. And they are, keeping them working, which is clearly part of the challenge of preserving these things. And maybe some of you aren't going to care so much for this, but the people at Farsight who are doing Pinball Arcade and other folks, I'm just kind of pointing to them. This is important work. Now emulation of pinball is not pinball, but it is a form of preservation, right? So this is something that we think about with video games as well, where we know eventually that game that is on that 5 1/4 floppy disk is not going to work anymore. So you get images of the game, you store the basically the essence of the game in order to emulate it in the future. And emulation is not the same as the original game. It's just not. But if in 100 years, you can't play a pinball machine from the 40s, perhaps you can emulate it, right? So there is a kind of preservation work that is going on there. Again, it's not my favorite, or I often think of emulation as being a last resort, but it is a kind of preservation work. So I want to talk a little bit about the Strong's approach to preserving the history of pinball specifically. So the first thing is that we collect, preserve, and in many cases, and I'll talk more about this, we make accessible at various levels original pinball machines, right? And this is just an example of a few of them, but it goes back to the 30s and then to pre-proto pinballs to Bagatelle. One of the things I'll mention here that I think is unique about the Strong, compared to really any other place on the planet, is that we can place something like pinball within the wider context of the culture and play. So, you know, I think I was saying this to Duncan the other day, that we will we'll get researchers from all over the world who will come and study you know, different aspects of play, and we've had game designers who think that they've invented some sort of game mechanic, and then you find that, you know, they come to the museum and they find that no, you know, that's been around since 1912 actually. You didn't invent that. So there is we're unique in the way that we can trace this history back, and we can connect these objects and these stories to earlier forms of play. Now, having the original machines poses some very big questions. So what do you do with original pinball machines? So at the museum, as opposed to artifacts — they are artifacts, but we call these machines usifacts, because at a when you think of a traditional museum, right, these are not places — you don't go into a history museum and they don't, you know, you don't go to the National Archives and they don't hand you the Declaration of Independence and say, here you go, you know, oh, do you want to make, you know, copies or something? Go ahead. So there's something different going on here when you allow the public to play an artifact. But we think it's very important to have people, to have examples of playthings that people can actually play. So we call these usifacts, and the first usifact we really had was this early 20th century carousel. And this is what started us really thinking hard about how do you allow the public to play with a museum artifact? How do you do that? And as we incorporated and grew our collection of arcade machines and pinball machines, we really needed to confront some big questions about that kind of experience. And so for us as a museum, what are acceptable preservation and conservation techniques for games? And so one of the things we did is we thought about, well, what sort of models are there, right? And there's a tradition of, it's often called historic preservation, but it's really architectural preservation. We looked at that, and we thought of that as really an incredibly useful model. And so if you're looking at the pictures up here, what you're seeing here are, does anybody — I bet maybe Duncan might recognize this — but does anybody know what these pictures up here are of?
Monticello.
Not Monticello. Close, though. Very close. Mount Vernon, yes. Excellent. Mount Vernon. So Mount Vernon is really the, like, Plymouth Rock of architectural preservation. It is the place where that history begins, and it was through a movement by a group of women, the Ladies of Mount Vernon, who really stepped up and saved Mount Vernon, which was George Washington's house, for those of you who forget about that from or forgot about it from grade school or something. But so what you're seeing here, though, you're seeing a picture from the 19th century, because the mid-19th century is when these women said, okay, this house is getting into disrepair. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be saved. It's a historic monument. And now you're seeing a picture of what Mount Vernon looks like today. Now, I probably don't have to ask you, but you can tell that it looks different, right? It's not the same exact home. You can see at the very least they have taken out the columns and, you know, that really that porch there. But really they started this movement towards architectural preservation. And one of the things that comes up with architectural preservation are, what sorts of choices are we making when you go into George Washington's house, you have to make a decision. You have to say, okay, do we want George Washington's house to look like it did when George Washington lived in it, which is very difficult to do without actually knowing what that looked like specifically, or do we want it to be representative? It's a living thing. It's a home, right? People have lived in it. Should it look like people have lived in it? And you have to make choices about that, and they've made choices where clearly you always do some combination of these things. But often in the pinball world, you know, I see a lot of like ads for, you know, museum quality restoration, which is sort of funny for me just because we don't really do restoration. Museums don't talk about restoring things. They conserve them. Because, you know, restoration is one of these things where I think true restoration is probably impossible. It's impossible to make anything. All of you who have played pinball know that pinball is a kind of living artifact, and you can have one, one firepower next to another firepower, and those two machines play differently, right? So what does it mean to really restore that game? And so for us, it comes down to these questions of, you know, is a game still an original game if you've changed the play field? Is a game still an original game if you've changed the back glass? There are people who don't believe, you know, who don't think that a game is an original game if it has a screw on it that is not, you know, that was not originally on that thing. And so we constantly need to assess that and make these choices. And as you know, there's wear and tear. So everything that we put out, we have to decide, well, what is it that we're going to do that is going to change this? So part of figuring that out is thinking about, how do you categorize a collection of pinball machines? And so in terms of conservation, we thought a lot about architectural preservation. In terms of, in trying to categorize the collection and understand how to approach it, we looked at library conservation. And we used that as a model. Right? So we've broken it down into a general collection, and these are games that are available for play to museum guests. Right? Anyone can play them. And then into a special collection, where we've broken them down into subsections. And so the first is a monitored collection, which are generally games that are available to play by guests after they're approved. So it means that we need to assess, okay, is this game okay really to be played? And then they're closely monitored. You know, so for us, an example of that, might be a game like, Vagabond. Right, so it's a game that has some historical significance because it was the game that introduced the drop target. It's a game that was an Attaball machine, so there were fewer of them made, probably 500 or 600 of those made. So all of these things go into thinking about, where do we categorize these things? Can it be replaced? What sort of parts are available for it? Are they original parts? Are they manufactured? Are they new old stock? Are they new manufactured? And what does it mean to put them on these games? We have a controlled collection, which may be available for play by researchers, but will not be available for play to the general public. You know, so something like maybe Humpty Dumpty or Triple Action. Other games where there are few examples of them left, we don't want people to play those every day, because we have to make sure that we're preserving these artifacts. And I should mention too that part of conservation principles is that things that we're doing to the artifacts, they need to be reversible in almost all cases. So if you think of art conservation, right, people remember that, I'm forgetting the name of the painting, but a few years ago, the woman who just slapped paint all over that, yeah. So, things like that are not reversible. Yeah.
In the past 15 to 20 years, there have been some people who have actually bought brand new pinball games and not taken them out of the box deliberately. What is the museum point of view on something like that?
Well, the museum's point of view is that we're not doing that. If people do that, that's great. I mean, it's the comparison is like we get objects that say, if you look at Star Wars action figures, we're going to get some that are in their original packaging. In that case, the packaging actually tells us a lot about the object that's inside. But also, we have a lot of action figures that have been played with, right? It's really all about the provenance or the story of the thing itself. So it's great to have a game new in box, but for us
You would take it out of the box, assuming.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't do a whole lot. I mean, in terms of pinball, it's in a brown cardboard box. Maybe we'll keep the cardboard box because that's also in the National Toy Hall of Fame, and kids love to play with cardboard boxes. But I can't imagine us putting a cardboard box on with a game on display, for instance. But yeah, if people want to do that, then more power to them. I'll mention the last collection is a restricted collection, and these are not available for play by anybody really under any circumstances. The only circumstances that they might be available for play is to do some sort of video capture to actually record what is it actually like to play this game. I don't think we have anything in that collection in terms of pinball at the moment. We acquired a large collection of Atari coin-op materials and the game Maze Invaders, which was a game that there was only two of those made. That's a game that's in our restricted collection. It's not something we're going to have people play because there's only two examples of it that are in existence. And the first principle of conservation is do no harm. So the first approach is collect the original pinball machines, kind of think about what it is you're doing in terms of preserving them. And the second is to collect and preserve media and publish materials about pinball. Right? So this isn't rocket science at all. It's stuff that is related to the industry. It's stuff that's related to the games that has been published that is generally available, whether it's Pin Game Journal, which are the more of the collectors, enthusiast magazines, the trade journals, flyers, company newsletters, all of these sorts of things are important artifacts. They're important resources for understanding, both helping to understand the history, but also as primary sources for people to study this down the road. And the last thing is archival materials. And what I mean by archival materials are often one-of-a-kind materials, things that tell us more about that part. Often it's the part of the focus that we talked about with the producers. Right, so archival collections, papers, business records, any sort of data that is attached to a game, a plaything. Again, these are photographs of our library and archive. These are stacks. This is a picture of me and our one of our archivists, Julia Novakovic, who. And we're just looking at some of the Atari coin-op materials that came in. But these are all one-of-a-kind or generally one-of-a-kind things. And just as a kind of quick aside here, We have collections that span from, so Brian Sutton Smith, who is our sort of namesake for the library and archive, we have his papers. So we have collections of papers and work from scholars who have studied play. We have collections from companies, whether it's Gund, Atari, Broderbund, which was the company that made, and some of you or your kids knew, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, personal papers, Ralph Baer, who created the first video game, and the list sort of goes on and on. I want to give you a few examples at the end here of the kinds of collections that we've been getting that are related to pinball and how we think about these things. So recently, we acquired through donation that came from WMS a collection of original drawings from Williams that go back to really the first pinball machines that the company made. And the really important part of that collection are these original playfield drawings that were drawn by guys like Harry Williams and Sam Stern and Steve Kordek, Norm Clark, Harry Mabbs, right? And this is actually an example of, I was talking to Duncan about this example of a drawing from Nifty, which, Harry here is writing, he wasn't living in Chicago at the time, and he's writing to Gordon explaining, it's Gordon Horlick, explaining to him exactly how this game works, how it is that he's, what are the rules, how is it going to work, because you can look at a drawing and have no idea exactly, how the game's supposed to work. And I really want to thank, these are the kind of collections that are crucial to preserve. And they're particularly knowing the history of, sort of the Gottlieb materials are, destroyed, advertising posters. There's all these really unfortunate histories of kind of a lack of preservation. But, I'm eternally grateful for WMS saving these things, Steve Kordek really kind of putting some of this stuff aside, and then Gary Flower and Duncan Brown for facilitating this eventual donation. And I want to show you a couple more things quickly and try to leave some time for questions, but just to give you a couple more examples, these are things that we found in some of the oversized materials that came with the Atari Coin-Op Division's collections. There are some pinball materials there. And these are assembly drawings. The one up here is obviously for the stencils for Superman. Does anybody recognize the bottom one, what you're looking at here? Yeah, Dave. Yes. Right, the flipper assemblies, the flippers for Hercules, which are really one of the cool things about that game. So there are materials like this. There are some materials that really get into some of the business of pinball at Atari, but it's the bulk of the Atari materials are assembly drawings for in regards to pinball. I found this. One of our archivists found this recently, and I was actually really excited to bring this to Pinball Expo because I thought, maybe somebody will. I don't know if there's. I'm guessing there's nobody in the room who worked for Atari in their pinball division in the late 70s. There are a few people here. Yeah. So this was a game that they never made, and I looked on Internet Pinball Database, and there's no there's no record of it, and it was called Queen of Hearts, and this was drawn in 1978, and it's a game that just was never made, but it's the drawing that you're seeing here. It's three different drawings of Playfield artwork. And there's really only a few records, other records that go with this. There's a couple of drawings for gates and spinners and things, but it's a beautiful, obviously beautiful artwork, but it's certainly something that, you know, it's great to find this stuff that was never made, particularly with Atari, who didn't really make a lot of pinball machines. But certainly, if anyone knows of anyone who can tell us more, can shed a little bit more light, what's that, Dave?
Dan Kramer in California has presented an expo in the past about Atari prototypes and games they didn't make.
Yeah. So this is something that, you know, is going to happen, and this is one of the reasons that we rely a lot on everyone kind of understanding, you know, what's out there and helping us kind of understand, you know, everything that's here. So just to kind of wrap this up, I want to think about really how preservation develops, where we go from here. And it develops through conversations, right? The reason that, you know, we have Ralph Baer's papers and Will Wright's papers and the Williams drawing, these things, are because we're constantly in conversation with everything here. You can tell I like circles, obviously. And so it's really conversations that you see that it's a circle around pinball preservation. So all of these things have to be in conversation with each other. You know, so if you think about scholars, right, people who are doing research on games, they often provide us, right, they come to us and they have questions. And they have questions that you could never anticipate. And so you say, well, what sorts of sources do we need to actually answer those kinds of questions? Right? And that helps us understand how to really, what sorts of things do we need to continue to have conversations about? You have producers, right, the people who have created the games, consumers, the people who are buying them, collectors, like many of you here. I really can't emphasize the importance of collectors. You know, really, you guys are the people who save stuff. I mean, that's in almost every case, except when you look at government archives, in almost every case, collectors see the value of something before a museum does. And so continually need to be in conversation with these groups. And I put technology in here because technology is one of the biggest factors that mediates our conversations. It's constantly changing. And all of these things are constantly changing. The producers are changing, the people studying them are changing, the people buying them and collecting them are changing. And so we have to adapt to new technologies, to new producers, to all these things. So conversations must always continue. Okay, thank you. I hope we have time for any questions. Okay.
I'm going to start out. There's actually quite a bit of oral history material. There's recordings of all these seminars.
Yes.
Every year, plus
yes.
All the podcasts. Many of the podcasts involve getting someone who worked in a factory to recall things they did. I'm curious, though, about do you have much capacity to do things with audio material, or would you just be archiving it somewhere, waiting for a researcher who needs it for something?
So, really, all of those things. So the tricky part of oral history is that for it to be done well, it does require a lot of time and resources. Generally, what we found is that with a lot of oral histories, we look at this stuff and think about creating an actual program, you find that a lot of stuff's out there already. You find that, you know, if you really sit down with a person, you're often getting the same story over and over and over again. And so either you've got to ask different questions, or you've got to think of a different strategy for, you know, how to approach it. So for us, often we have a game designer or someone who comes to the museum, and I cannot tell you how beneficial that is to have somebody walk through there with you. George Gomez from Stern has visited the museum, and walking around with him was incredible, because here's a guy who's been in the toy industry, he's been in the video game industry, and he's also, you know, obviously in pinball, and he just seeing, you know, different things on display, seeing things in the archive, bring up things that you would have never heard in an oral history or never heard in an interview. So it's really that's the stuff that I love to record, and it's very challenging, because often you're getting people, you know, to stop there for, you know, a couple hours or something, and so you don't want to spend a couple hours with them just on can I record you while we walk around a museum. But it's definitely part of an approach. It's part of a comprehensive approach to preserving the history. And I know that I've communicated with Rob about digitizing the talks that are here. That is a major project. I mean, I don't think I realized at the time how many seminars and how many hours of footage there is. And we're at present time, we're also dealing with about 3,000 videos that came from Atari that we're kind of assessing. And you're talking everything back to U-matic tape, you know, to VHS and Beta and everything. So I appreciate the question. It's definitely something we're continually thinking about. Other questions? Yeah, James.
Now that you have these prints, or not prints, but drawings,
yeah,
how does the person off the street, how are they going to have access to them? Are they going to have access to them?
Yes, so, they'll have access to them in a number of ways. First, the museum will be opening a permanent pinball exhibit in early 2016, and so there will be, I'd probably say, I have to have more conversations with our conservator about this, but I'd be willing to bet that we'd probably put reproductions of them out for people to see rather than the actual artifact. Some of it is just a question of lighting and filtering and humidity control and all of that. But we do exhibit things. But in terms of people coming in and seeing them, you can go to iCheg.org or museumofplay.org, and you can set up an appointment to come in and see them. At the present, because we just recently received these, they need to be conserved. They need to be actually archived. So everything has to be rehoused in acid-free folders. So it's a process. We create a finding aid so that people actually know what it is they're looking at. But by the end of this year, I would suspect that the collection will be ready, and, you know, people can contact us and you know, come in and look at it. Other questions? Yeah, Jim.
I know that you talked about it a little bit, controversial between preservation and restoration, especially in Charleston, and some of the mansions were restored,
yep,
and some were preserved. And the same thing with the bodies is that, I mean, to me, it's interesting how it gets to the detail, like the factory made that bad glass. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, thanks. So the answer to your question is that we do have a comprehensive conservation policy when it comes to these games that kind of, where I could go into much more detail about each one of those collections that I talked about. But it's something that is really game specific. We have to actually take into account everything about that game, everything about that object. And is this something where, for instance, you know, there's a whole thing about do we put LEDs in, you know, in wood rail machines, right? And there'll be some people who will really be pissed off at you if you put an LED in there. You know, but then on the other hand, you look at it and you go, okay, well, you know, we have machines where the original plastics have been melted because the bulb that's in there is too damn hot. So it's really specific to the game. You have to make those.
Even that, you're golfing. We put in 47s, I think, the color 44s.
Yeah.
But it's 47s. It's a little lower. But then it's not original. You know?
Right.
But then with golf, it's not the same ball.
That's exactly right. You have to make, right, at a certain point, you have to make decisions about what are essentially expendables, right? So the pinball itself is a great example of that, right? You know, the pinball that comes with the machine is not going to be, in most cases, the pinball that is still, you know, at the museum that is...
Really cool. You've got a whole machine that actually...
The original pinball, yeah. And, you know, the older the machine, there's actually, I think, a better chance of that because... You know, people didn't change them, right? But then they destroy the playfield. Yeah.
I have a better example, and that is in the flipper frenzy of 1948. People were taking their older games and buying these flipper add-on kits. Now it's proper business history to preserve what they did by adding that flipper add-on kit.
Yeah.
But it's what it does for. The designer's intent, you know, a lot of these kits were put on in ways that are just ridiculous, that clearly violated what the designer was intending. So from your, talking about a manufactured object, what did the factory intend, then you're kind of contradicting the story. So ideally you'd have one of each, you know, unmodified and modified.
Yes, right. So that's an excellent point, right? And you're... You know, that you're probably never going to be able to get one of each of everything. But what you do is, that's what curation is all about, is really having to make decisions about what examples are you going to have. So the best thing is, you know, to have an example of a pre-flipper game and to have an example of a game that, you know, is a pre-flipper game where someone has modified it. So that we can record that, because in some ways that's kind of like, it's almost folk culture, right? It's not... You know, it's how you record that, really. You know, and the same thing goes with games today where people are modifying them, right? So we have examples of games that we acquired specifically because they were heavily modified. So again, it's not the original game, but it's an example of what collectors do. How do people play with these objects? And modifying the game... is a form of play. You know, the other thing I'll point out here, which is a real challenge, I think Jack had, the other day was talking about this with someone asking about updates for games, more modern games, right? This is something we think about all the time in terms of electronic games, PC games, pinball machines. Well, what is the game anymore, right? You have updates which are supposed to be, okay, it's fixing a bug, it's improving the game. But, you know, so what is the game then if you're on update 5? Like, is it the original game that came out when it came out? Or is it, you know, and how do you save all those updates? How do you document that? So there are a lot of challenges to doing that kind of work. Yeah.
I'm sure with the museum you have the same kind of problems that collectors have, and that's space is finite. Are there any guiding principles that you go through in saying, okay, we want to take this, you know, acquire this piece, but this one might not be socially or as relevant, or we want to take this over this, or where is there like a line where a certain item might not make the cut to be part of the museum?
Or be divested when you get a better example?
Okay, well, those are two different things, but the first being that, it again, it's really a case-by-case basis, because there's an important distinction, and that's that, hey, I want to have an example of, you know, Paragon or something, because we want something from that era. We want, you know, a wide body cabin, you know, whatever the questions that we want to consider, the artwork. You know, so yes, we want to think about, are there condition issues? Are there things that we can address? You know, we want to ask all these questions. But, you know, there's this distinction, because, you know, you have games that have stories. And so, for instance, you know, if, you know, you have a, you know, a good example of this is if you have, you know, a high-speed machine, but, you know, Steve Ritchie says, you know, oh, I'd like to donate my personal high-speed machine. Well, that's really about the provenance of the object. Or, for instance, you know, you have a toy that, you know, we just have that's in the original package, but then we have one that was played with by someone, right? What's the story? You know, can we record anything there? So it becomes important, and, you know, a lot goes into making those distinctions. And then I'm just going to quickly address Dave's comment. In terms of what you're talking about, what we call deaccessioning objects, that's something we take very, very seriously. And so everything I just talked about is considered in when you propose deaccessioning an object, right? Do we have a better example? But maybe the better example isn't Steve's, you know, original high speed. But that process, it would be a curator proposing something being deaccessioned. Then that needs to go to a committee, which then goes to the board and the CEO. It's an ethical thing. And that any money or anything that comes from deaccessioning an object from the museum goes back into the museum's collection and caring for those things, so that I can just make it clear that there will be no, like, fire sales of things because the because the economy is bad. We're financially stable, and we don't have to worry about those sorts of things. We are not the city of Detroit. We were very fortunate in that Margaret Woodbury Strong left behind many millions of dollars that we do not actually manage. Just quickly, our operating budget is about $14 million, and about half of that comes from admissions and, you know, just sort of the regular things of grants and all of that. And the other half comes from a trust that that we don't manage. We can't touch the principal of that. So we are financially stable. You know, the museum and everything in it will be there well after I'm dead and gone. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Good job, buddy. Thank you so much.